So first of all, let me thank Sridi for kind invitation. It gives me a possibility to share our results and thoughts with you and everyone's community. As it has been already announced, I came from Oregon, where I work as a member of a group which is led for a long time by Raj Malani. I came back about 3 years ago. And these experiments on supercomputing, they were already on. And they started with Mike Smith, who did thesis on that stuff. It was then carried by Steve Stahl, and I just jumped into this business, trying to help to analyze the experimental data with Steve about 3 years ago. And currently, we share our time on 2 experiments with Joe Nigma. We work at the same time on high frame number collection using gradually green graphs and on supercomputer turbines. And I must mention the very fruitful collaboration with many people. Out of those, I'd like to emphasize the long-lasting collaboration with Joe Weiner. And I had that nice possibility and good luck to work with Joe Weiner for several years in Birmingham together back in the 90s. And of course, we strongly benefit from close collaboration with him and his expertise in turbulence is invaluable for us. But in this respect, I would also very much like to thank Greg Ayen, who was very kind with me and on many occasions tried to explain the fluid turbulence and various aspects to me. And actually, there were some suggestions. They were very important for the work I'm going to explain or even to describe. So the outline of my talk is the following. I would like to properly introduce the topic because I believe that this is mostly the turbulent community and this is more or less on the side. So I would like to talk a little bit about you and what the model basis of this experiment. I will then describe experimental setup and our results. And then I will try to share with you our results on modeling of decaying homogeneous and isotopic turbulence. About 4 regimes of decay in the final channel we have found recently. And then, last, I'd like to talk about effective and explosive of helium-2 and its temperature dynamics and conclude. So let me start with the basics. So there are 2 isotopes of helium stable in nature. Excuse me, just before that.
Thank you. There are 2 stable isotopes, and those are helium-4 and helium-3. And helium-4 is a boson because it has 4 protons and 4 neutrons in the nucleus, and helium-3 is a fermion. And because of that, their quantum statistics are very different, and their properties at low temperatures are completely different. In my talk, I am not going to touch the isotope helium-3 at all. I'm only going to talk about helium-4. Helium-4, actually, the name helium came from the sun because it was discovered last century in 1868. It was calculated from the spectral line coming from the sun. It was then discovered on the Earth late in the last century, and it was the last element to be liquefied. It was only possible to liquefy it at 1908 by Kamerlingh-Onnes in Leiden, which marks the beginning of the low-temperature physics. It's a very light liquid. At normal pressure, it liquefies at 4.2 kelvin, so very close to absolute zero indeed, and it's a very peculiar one. You can see that at the phase diagram, there is not a triple point. So, for example, if you follow this line and you try to cool the helium down, whether you go along the saturated vapor pressure curve or whether you keep the pressure constant, it never solidifies. So it's called quantum liquid for various reasons. But it is very attractive for turbulence research because, and I can flash it only here, the kinematic viscosity of these 3 fluids, I mean helium gas, also offers very high degree of versatility. Helium-1 and helium-2, whichever way you define the kinematic viscosity, they are indeed very low, lowest from known fluids. And that's why that are very suitable to carry on high Reynolds number turbulence research. So let me go back to this phase diagram to tell you that in these experiments we were close to the saturated vapor pressure line, roughly between 1 and 2 kelvins. So we work below this line here, which is called the lambda line, because something interesting happens in helium as you cool it down. And you can see it in the cryostat. For example, if you just pump the pressure down, you see the helium boiling. It boils like water, and at roughly 2.18K, the boiling suddenly stops, and the helium becomes superfluid. And what happens is that the heat conductivity increases enormously, and at temperatures below lambda point, the helium-2 is about 200 times better conductor than copper at room temperatures. So there is a really dramatic increase in heat conductivity. And this is the second order transition which happens there, which was only discovered long after liquefying of helium-2 in late 30s. That was common effort of several people by Kapitsa in Russia and by Allen and Jones and the other people in the Western world. And there are some features of this remarkable fluid which do really not have any classical analog. One of them is here. So for example, if you have a bath of helium-4, which is then called helium-2, maybe I should clarify this point really clearly. So we are talking about helium-4, but normal helium-1 above the lambda point is called helium-1, and it is ordinary Navier-Stokes fluid. For historical reasons, the helium below the lambda point is called helium-2, and it's superfluid. And you have helium gas here. That's the critical point here. So there is nothing peculiar about helium-1. What I am talking about is helium-2, superfluid one.
Why close to that green line of the helium-2? You said that you made the experiment
in... We can't go experimentally lower than 1K. It's very difficult to achieve temperatures below 1K unless you use special methods. And that's also because, as I'm going to say, we are using the second salt attenuation, and second salt attenuation is very difficult to use below 1 Kelvin because there is hardly any normal fluid left. But I will come to the question later.
Place the figure where the experiment is more or less?
Here.
At the green line?
Right. Just above or at the saturated vapor pressure line.
Okay. This is for
the helium-2 experiment. The convection experiment is here. Okay. Yes. Yeah, that's definitely not. That's not more or less Navier-Stokes. If anything deserves to be called Navier-Stokes fluid, that would be rather helium than anything else because of the symmetry of the atom.
So you can study it all
in your study. No, we just go below the lambda transition and then we study the properties of the superfluid of helium-2.
So, and what you're going to talk about helium-2 are not a convection experiment.
No. I'm just introducing the helium-2 that you have a flavor of what helium-2 is all about. Just trying to say that, for example, if you have a beacon and you just half put it into helium-2, so there is a helium film, which by itself will fill this up after some while. Then you can take it up and it will empty itself. So these are really some peculiar features which do not have any classical analog. So there is something really special about this fluid. All right, so experimentally what you do is that you have, say, a glass UR, small one, which you pack with some fine powder, say emery powder, and close the ends, and then, well, the end is actually open then, right? But it's only some cotton wool or something like that to prevent this powder to fall out. And then you put some flashlight on, that means you just apply some heat flux inside. And what you see is a little fountain, which goes out from this upper end, several centimeters up. This has no classical analog. And it has to be explained somehow, and took long time for people just to realize that this might be connected with what is called Bose condensation. So because helium is boson, so it obeys the Bose statistics, and as Einstein showed in 24, for ideal Bose gas in three dimensions in the momentum space, there is a condensation into the lowest energy level, in such a way that there is macroscopic number of particles, they occupy this. And you can calculate within this simple model what will be number of these particles and what would be the temperature if this happened. And it's indeed very close to the experimentally observed temperature. So you can smile, but only for a while, because this is just a model of non-interacting Bose gas. And if you take into account the corrections and stuff like that, you would expect that you get closer to the truth. But in fact, you go further from the truth, and it's very difficult to explain anything directly in terms of the Bose condensations only. As a matter of fact, the best description we have so far is a phenomenological one, which was introduced by Landau in the 40s based on the results of Kapitsa experiments. And there is a very beautiful experiment of Randall Nikashvili, which really confirms at least some truth and validity of the Landau description. Landau guessed the form of the energy spectrum in superfluid helium in such a way that it is very peculiar one. It has a phonon branch and a quadratic roton branch. And he says then, we can treat helium as a peculiar mixture of two fluids. One of them we will call normal fluid, and that would be actually the gas of interactions with phonons and rotons. And hydrodynamically, you can describe that as ordinary Navier-Stokes fluid and superfluid, which will not carry any entropy, will be inviscid, and we'll have the density rho s in such a way that the total density is a combination of these two. And you can measure these densities by this experiment. You have a pile of very closely spaced disks. And because normal fluid has a viscosity, if these disks are very closely spaced and you perform torsion oscillations, normal fluid will be carried with these disks. So you can observe a change in the period of torsion oscillations. From that you can calculate, as a function of temperature, what is the ratio between the normal and superfluid. So this is a beautiful experiment which helped to verify that this is indeed possible. And just to give you a flavor of what Landau theory can do, you can write hydrodynamic equations on different levels, taking different things into account. But the simplest level, which I want to demonstrate at least somehow to give you a flavor of what you can do, is here. So you can, for example, write an analog of the continuity equation, taking into account that there are two fluids with completely independent velocity fields, Vn and Vs. So that would be the continuity equation in the simplest form from two-fluid model. If you consider non-dissipative processes, you can write an equation for conserving of the entropy. And entropy is only carried by the normal fluid, not by superfluid. Or you can write a Navier-Stokes fluid, Navier-Stokes equation for the total flow. You take the superfluid part and the normal part, and this term here, or ordinary dissipating term, will be only because of the normal fluid, because the superfluid will not contribute to that. And I'm doing that because if you then take into account that the superfluid flow is potential, I will come to that a little bit later, you can write down the system of equations and you can linearize them. And once you do that in terms of the Landau model, you can write down the sound equations for helium 2. And you can solve these equations in approximation that there are small changes in density and entropy. And if you seek the solution in terms of the plane waves, you find out that something peculiar happens, that there is not only one solution, but two solutions. And these solutions are called first and second sound. First sound propagates also in ordinary helium, obviously, because it's just ordinary kind of sound. you have a density wave in which the normal and superfluid fraction oscillates in phase with each other. But you have also the other solution, which is called the second sound. And in second sound, the superfluid and normal fraction oscillate against each other in such a way that the total density stays unchanged. So you can think about that not as a pressure wave, but rather as an entropy wave, or because superfluid doesn't carry any entropy, as a temperature wave. It doesn't have any analogy in normal fluid, in classical liquid. You can see that experimentally. It was discovered in 1944 by Peshkov. It's not as simple as it is here, but schematically, if you have a heater and you put the AC current there, you can send a temperature wave across. And if you have a sensitive thermometer with fast response, you can see this temperature wave on the other side. And this is the velocity of the second sound as compared to the first sound velocity. Obviously, it only starts below the lambda point, but good thing is it's rather flat in this experimental region here. It actually has two extrema, one at roughly 165 and one at roughly 1.15, which for us experimenters is the best place to perform experiments, because if we have some kind of temperature instability, it hardly matters. Now, I said that helium is a quantum fluid. So I, by necessity, have to talk a little bit about quantum mechanics. And it was a great idea of London that the superfluid helium can be described by a macroscopic wave function. Normally, if you describe any particle by a wave function, of course it has an amplitude and a phase. But if you have an ensemble of many particles, these phases, they average out, and the phase normally doesn't carry any useful physical information. If you have a macroscopic wave function, and you apply the normal kind of machinery of quantum mechanics, so if you apply the impulse operator, you immediately see that this macroscopic phase acts as a potential for a superfluid flow. This is a scalar quantity here. This is a gradient of a scalar quantity. This is a superfluid velocity. Take a curl of that, and immediately from here, you have a condition of irrotationality. So the superfluid flow, using this approach, must be irrotational. I would like to point out the similarity with superconductors. So superfluidity and superconductivity are two sides of the same coin. So there is this similarity, for example, in that in superconductor also, superfluid or supercurrent is given by the gradient of the phase. And also, there is a condition similar to that in helium for applied. Of course, if that's a wave function, it must be a solution of some kind of Schrödinger equation. And I think Professor Brachet will talk about that in his talk. So here you don't talk about Ginzburg-Landau approach, but rather about the Gross-Pitayevsky approach, but let's leave that for the afternoon. Right. So this irrotational condition, potential flow, sets interesting questions. Okay, what happens if I have a rotating bucket? There is a meniscus on the rotating bucket of the ordinary liquid, and if I have now two fluid model, where only the normal fluid has a viscosity and superfluid doesn't, so the shape of this meniscus must be different. Yes? That's an interesting experiment. We predict that. And it was quite clear for people it must be like that, until in 1956, Osborne did rotate indeed. And he found an interesting thing, that the superfluid meniscus exhibits exactly the same shape on the average as the normal fluid meniscus. How is that? What is wrong? Already in 1949, Lars Onsager, in some unpublished remark, suggested that in helium-2, the circulation can be quantized. Independently, then Feynman worked on this problem and came with the concept of quantized vortices, and showed that the superfluid flow is potential only in singly connected regions. And if you consider multiply connected regions, you can actually get around this condition. And that's because if you believe that you can describe the motion using this macroscopic wave function, it must be single valued. But you can go around something, you can change the phase by 2 pi, and the wave function is still the same. That means that the circulation is quantized in units of quantum circulation, which is roughly 10 to minus 7 meters squared per second, or 10 to minus 3 centimeters squared per second. It is connected with that, but it's not exactly the same, and that would be different matter.
You'd say this is a topological.
Yes. You may think about this wave function as being an order parameter, and you may think about this quantum vortex line as a line singularities in the order parameter. Anyway,
what's not simply connected in when I rotate
the vortex line?
Vortex line has a core which is normal.
And there is a singularity.
Yes. And to remove that singularity, you must say that the vortex core is normal or hollow or whatever.
Yeah.
It turns out that these vortex cores are only as small as one angstrom of that order. So it really doesn't matter. It doesn't have any mass or anything. It doesn't matter.
Could I make an interruption? In this 15 minutes, had summarized the whole book that Rastan wrote. So, I think he has so many things he has said, but I would like to take a minute with his permission to interrupt and remark what I think are the essential things. That is, if you look at the phase diagram he has, which is for helium-4, there is a part that is Navier-Stokes, which is helium-1 liquid state and the gaseous state below the coexistence line. Below the lambda point is helium-2, which is special, which is the fluid that he is going to be talking about. It has, phenomenologically speaking, two components, the normal part and the superfluid part. The normal part is thought to be just like classical fluid, and the superfluid part is the special part, is the part that makes it special. And the ratio of the two fluids depends on the temperature. Closer you are to zero, absolute zero, more and more is the superfluid part. And the special properties of the superfluid part is it carries no entropy, for instance. It is irrotational, as he said. And it has a second cylinder, that is, it carries a temperature wave, for instance. And the speed of this is about 30 meters per second, as he showed, up to about 1 degree Kelvin. Now, the superfluid part, the quantum mechanics comes in the following way. That is, if the speed of the superfluid is slow, then it is irrotational. There is nothing special about no vorticity involved there. However, if it exceeds a certain critical velocity, then you have a formation of vortex lines or vortices. These are the ones that he was talking about as the multiply connected regions. And quantum mechanics comes in so far as the properties of these vortex lines are governed by quantum mechanics, and these are the order of 1 angstrom in radius. Then they are the ones that, if you go up in speed, become like a spaghetti mess, completely mix that out in a turbulent manner, which is what is superfluid turbulence. So the question is the connection between superfluid turbulence, its properties, and the transport.
And I'm coming to that just now.
Why can't you need critical velocity? I don't understand that. Why is it critical velocity?
That's because if you want to create the singularity in the middle of the fluid, you can't do it. You can do it only on the wall. because of the topological restrictions. You can do that on the wall, but because if you are close to the wall, there will be an image vortex in the wall, there will be an energy barrier which you have to overcome to create a quantum vortex. And it's difficult to do that. And there are two ways of creating these vortices. One is intrinsic vortex nucleation, and the other one is what is called extrinsic vortex nucleation. Intrinsic, if you don't have any other vortices in a helium sample, you have to create the first vortex intrinsically, because there are no vortices there. In practice, it is very difficult to have any sample of helium-2 without any remnant vorticity. That's because if you consider even the Earth's rotation, in the equilibrium there are about 220 vortices per meter square simply due to Earth's rotation. So you have always remnant vortices in your sample, whatever you do, the more they are going to be pinned on the wall. So you have to consider the extrinsic vortex nucleations for macroscopic flow. And it's a lot easier, because you have already existing part of the vortex there, and you can get extra vortices by stretching it.
Can I see the last
Sure.
See, these vortices are not helium, not superfluid?
No. There are only in superfluid helium.
Yeah.
In normal helium, you can have vortices in the same sense that you are talking about vortices in classical turbulence, of course. But these are superfluid vortices. These are quantized vortices. These are vortices where the circulation is quantized with very, very small core, indeed, one angstrom.
Can one regard the superfluid velocity as being generated only by the vortices and ignore all the other parts?
No, because if you have a wave function which is whose amplitude and phase depends on space, then you will have potential flow which is not connected with vorticity. For example, by counterflow.
There is an additional potential flow.
Yes, you can, for example, set, and that's what I'm going to talk about just now. If you have two volumes, sorry.
In this two liquid picture, do you have vortex creation? You need to postulate it additionally. So do you have it
currently speaking? Yes, it is. But I'm afraid that this will carry us too far from the topic. I mean, I really didn't start the talk yet. So if you want to discuss this
we're going to discuss it next.
Okay. So what I want to say just to your question, you can have two different volumes connected, say, with some capillary, and you can apply a heat here, and because you apply a heat, because of this Bose condensate, that all thermodynamic functions are only dependent on temperature. There is nothing else to depend on, right? You set the counterflow, and you can study the counterflow turbulence here in this connecting region, and that's historically what the people did mostly. So the old experiments that are mostly done on superfluid turbulence in a counterflow. Because of the experimental regions, it is so easy to set it. You don't need any moving part in your cryostat. You just put a heater there, put some heat there, and you have a flow. So why to bother to put some flow fans there or something like that? It's much more difficult. But I am not going to talk about that in my talk. I am strictly going to consider constant temperature. Counterflow turbulence doesn't have any classical counterpart. Now we are talking about this rotating bucket thing, right? So what you actually have is a lattice, in an ideal case, a lattice of these vortices. It's a hexagonal lattice. You can show it from minimization of the free energy that it's hexagonal, and some image vortices. So it's not exactly hexagonal. But in a rotating frame, this lattice is stationary. But if the shape is not exactly cylindrical, if you have some kind of instability, these vortices, which look nice and straight here, they will tangle up and everything will be quite different. Right. For example, you may ask yourself what happens if you have a normal fluid, and in normal fluid, by hand, you impose the classical vortex. And you start with a very, very small quantized vortex loop here. This is a simulation by some of us. I picked one. There are many simulations like that. You show that if you prescribe this motion of the normal fluid, the superfluid flow will follow it very, very closely. And this is the history how it does it. The flow, the loop grows again, tangles up, and in the end, it tries to mimic this normal fluid flow as close as possible with the accuracy of this quantization. That's not only that. There are more experiments and more computer simulations, like this one, for example. This is by Carlo Barenghi, and what he does a similar thing. He sets in normal fluid what is called ABC flow. So this is like a mesh of circulating normal fluid vortices, one way, the other way, in all directions. And he lets the thing go, and after a while, the superfluid tries to mimic all this flow as closely as possible. What I want to say is the following. If you set any kind of flow in the normal fluid, the superfluid is trying always to mimic it as close as possible. Now, if you talk about turbulence, and you view the turbulence as a superposition of different size eddies, you might think that the superfluid will try to mimic all these normal fluid eddies as closely as possible. And all indications are that it indeed does.
What about the other way around? Did you set superfluid?
Yes, good question. These simulations, because of the way how they have been doing, they set the normal fluid in rotation and let it go without any change. But there are some new computer simulations by Carlo Barenghi also. And he, for example, showed that as the superfluid tries to match the normal fluid, it back influences the motion of the normal fluid. So it's self-adjusting process, right? But on the average, in the end, for example, for a pipe flow, you get the profile, Poiseuille-like profile, with quantized vortices in it, which is very, very closely to that of the classical fluid. Then
you have already made a statement that is not completely settled, you know, that
yes.
Connection between the two vortex spheres. You sort of made a blanket statement, which is the matter under discussion, so to speak.
Yes, I would like to say and emphasize it even, that you can define the superfluid turbulence, if you like, just in close analogy with this rotating bucket. For rotating bucket, this is strictly true that the macroscopic or RMS vorticity is given by the quantization constant, the circulation quantum, times the density of the line per cubic centimeter. So this quantity has a dimension centimeter per centimeter cubed. That means 1 per centimeter squared.
Is there vortex stretching of the superfluid?
Yes. Yes.
But it's quantized.
So it's quantized. The quantization stays constant all the time. But it's similar to ordinary fluid because you have Kelvin theorem in any ideal fluid, right? But the only difference is that here it is quantized. It is not quantized in the normal fluid, in ideal fluid.
So in a normal fluid, I imagine vortex stretching is increasing vorticity continuously. How should I imagine it?
Just here you don't have vortex line with any given value of the flux through it. But then, I mean, as long as you keep flux or circulation, you can just contract it, stop the stretching.
Now, he wants to know, if you have a vortex line in a batch couple, if you stretch it, it becomes more intense.
Yeah, but I mean, you conserve Kelvin theorem anyway.
That's very best.
Yeah,
I mean, you have Kelvin theorem.
Yes.
But now in Kelvin theorem, you cannot have any number, just some numbers.
No, the difference is the finite viscosity, right? In normal fluid.
The illustration you do, you conserve some circulation.
I have a simple answer. If you have a bunch of lines and they are being stretched, they get closer together.
Right.
So if you define an average vorticity, it grows.
So you're actually you're allowing for the thickness of these one angstrom things to
become closer, but what fixes the one angstrom length scale, this is not changing.
Yeah.
This doesn't get stretched. But it's a collective effect. If you want to think of it as increasing vorticity, you have to define an average vorticity.
I shouldn't think of something happening to a single line.
The single line doesn't get
So I guess single line can be stretched.
You can view the normal fluid stretching like the superfluid stretching if the quantization of circulation of quantum goes to zero, for example. So that would be the same thing. The picture will be.
Yes. Single line stretching doesn't make sense. And there is a suggestion that it's a collective coordination, and then they just get together and make a bundle, and that can stretch.
What about 2D? Do we have 2D problem?
Yes, you have 2D problem, which is completely different problem from this one. So there is this transition which is described by the Kosteritz, Taulus, Halperin and Young theory. And you have transition into crystallization on in superfluid helium film and so on and so on. But it's completely different topic. But yes, it is that problem there and it's being solved. I'm not sure that there is. No, I'm not sure that anyone made any strong connection between two-dimensional turbulence and the experimental observations yet. Although it should be. It is an interesting question. It is an interesting topic to work on.
Make this film, so.
Is there a certain tension associated with
Yes. Yes. What you have, actually, I didn't mention that here. If you look at this profile, or I can draw it, perhaps. If you look at this profile, normal fluid profile will be parabolic like that. And if you have these vortices going through, if I just enlarge it, the profile will look like that. So there will be small dimples here, which will be associated with this quantized vorticity, obviously. So the profile will look like this. But you don't see these, because they are microscopically small. But you can decorate them in superconductors, and you can decorate them with ions, and you can actually physically see these vortices in helium 4. There is not as simple as doubt that these vortices are there and exist. You can observe experimentally vortex waves on these vortices. They have very well defined features, and there is no doubt that these vortices exist. What is a problematic question is direct connection between this quantized vorticity and turbulence, and I'm going to talk about that now. This is the experiment of Patrick Tabeling and co-workers, and they measured the pressure variations in helium. And if I didn't tell you which of these curves is above and below the lambda transition, you wouldn't tell the difference. I remember that A is above the lambda transition, so the curve A is in normal helium 1. The curve 2 or B is just below the lambda transition. And the curve C is a temperature where there is hardly any normal fluid left. Well, hardly any normal fluid left means not literally, it's temperature about 1.3 K, I believe. And you can't see any difference. So at least in an inertial range, which is experimentally accessible, I don't know what happens down there. It is a good question to ask how the spectrum looks like close to the Kolmogorov or some kind of other dissipative length scale. In inertial range, you can see a scaling which is, roughly speaking, K41 Kolmogorov scaling.
This here that you have in astronomical units, is this for better or for
There's something wrong with that. I hope actually that Patrick will be here because these numbers are wrong. I mean, if you just.
Never mind that. Is it for pressure or for velocity?
This is for velocity.
This
arbitrary. But there must be perhaps, I think, two orders of magnitude difference in that. There must be some error because if you compare this with the absolute pressure, I mean, you get fluctuations of the order of absolute pressure, but. I hope to ask about that. He's not here.
What is it about that very peculiar spike?
No, that spike is of experimental origin. And they actually spent, he told me that, they spent a rough and tough time in order to filter out all different noises from all possible different sources, like 50 hertz, 60 hertz, and so on. So I believe that this is of experimental origin. At least he told me that. I don't know.
Same very, very constant in location.
Even Kolmogorov constant is not blowing perfectly under gravitational.
No. Kolmogorov constant seems to be constant. And I quote throughout this talk, Srinivas value 1.62. Well, up to the experimental accuracy, say. So there is.
No, I don't know. In fact, this is only qualitatively like that. You don't know in absolute terms. If
yes,
you're
normalized
by epsilon, you know, the way Kolmogorov wanted the thing normalized, I don't know if they all collapse.
So for each and every slope, normalization is different. So you
can not normalized.
Yeah, not normalized.
The relative strength is kind of right.
So the form is the same. Whether the amplitude is the same, I don't know. And I don't think Patrick knows. And if you have a statement to make, that would be useful. So from these measurements, you do not know whether the amplitudes are the same or you know.
No, I will tell you from where you can judge about the value of the Kolmogorov constant, but that will be later. But I must hurry up, sorry.
When you do that, when you talk about epsilon, there are the singularities in the vorticity of the superfluid part. So how am I going to take the gradient of velocity in a tool if I have a bunch of points where the thing is not defined?
Good and true, but it will be somewhere here, and we don't know.
And
I already stated that we don't know about the continuation of the spectrum here. This is the experimentally accessible part of the inertial range. So this is the K vector, which is well inside the inertial range. And I don't know, I don't have any clue, and nobody does, how it looks if you go closer to the Kolmogorov scale.
The vortex pillars you have probably have a minus one spectrum. And if you tangle them up, they will have a spectrum which is above minus one, so they have no effects. Mm-hmm. So they have no effects.
Yeah. Well, there are two spectrums. The spin curve is way above.
Yes. The normal fluid was in here.
Well,
not only. But, no, you measure the pressure. And the pressure variances are just the same for normal fluid and for superfluid, right? So you are sampling the pressure differences from a whole helium-2. And the point I want to make is that it doesn't matter whether you do it in normal fluid or whether you do it in superfluid, the slope stays constant. And it's comparable with minus 5 Ceres Kolmogorov like K41 scaling.
I just wanted to make a comment. If you think of length scales in the experiment, you have three long scales at least. One is the macroscopic injection, energy injection scale. Then you have the very, very small atomic scale diameter of the volume, which is on the order of the angstrom. And then you have some intermediate length scale, which is the average spacing between vortices. So if you think in terms of K minus one spectrum, you would expect to see it between the smallest and the intermediate scale. And now it turns out that, as far as I remember, the intermediate scale is something like a micron. So you just don't see it here as far.
It's far, yeah.
No.
That's the point. It isn't the normal fluid. And I want to emphasize that.
You should explain that a little bit more. That's the main point of confusion for everyone.
Can you say about the theorem?
Well, let's say that what we believe, they don't measure it. So what we believe is that this intermediate scale that you get, the mean separation between the vortices, is of the same order of magnitude in an experiment that you run in the superfluid regime. It will turn out to be the same order of magnitude as Taylor scale in the viscous regime if you run in Mellistos at higher temperatures. So this turns out to be.
It turns out it depends on temperature. I'm going to talk about that. Okay.
What was the mechanism for energy dissipation in superfluid? Because
there are many possible. Right. There are many possible, and nobody knows for sure. There are many possible mechanisms. Nobody knows whether reconnections of vortices is a dissipated mechanism or not. Nobody knows whether if you have a very small vortex ring, it collapses into something else and in the end just create some kind of phonons or anything else. So in the end what you have is actually you are adding to the normal fluid, right? There is some kind of dissipated mechanisms there and nobody knows the details. That's my answer and I don't know what to do with it.
We also took the solid fluid.
And that would mean that epsilon should be defined essentially as energy flux from the lab space, not by any equivalent of
Yeah. Superfluid entropy is by definition equal to zero from the lambda model.
Yeah. That
kind of complicates the visualization
of dissipation.
Yeah, okay. Let me go. I haven't started to talk yet. Sorry.
The thing is that we better clarify on this. I think the experiment, I even talked about Patrick's experiment somewhere.
I'll say a few words beginning with my talk.
I may say a few words about it if you like. And that's, it's true that intervortex spacing sets in a new scale. So you have the outer scale, say the size of the apparatus or energy containing length scale, whatever. Then you have this intervortex spacing which sets in another scale. And then you have the size of the vortex core as it was said already. And of course the Kolmogorov argument is dimensional argument. You may think about many dimensionless combinations if you include this intervortex spacing. For example, like another intermittency, which will be this D intervortex spacing times scale vector into some power mu, like the same thing. Or you have a circulation quantum, which is the dimension centimeter squared per second. You can combine it with the other scales and with the other quantities they go in, and all you can say is that some function of that dimensionless quantity must be present in the spectrum. Nobody knows up to now, until we measure, what is really the form of the scale at the very high wave vectors. We just approximated by Kolmogorov length scale during this talk. But whether that's true or not, I don't know.
What would be useful would be what is the experiment, what is being measured, and what is being plotted, and emphasize the point that, from between the three curves, one is a classical fluid and one is almost all superfluid.
Could you say what the experiment was about?
Say a word about how the experiment was done about. Okay, so what do you have? Is a something which is look like a Pitot tube, a small one, which is of the size of several millimeters. So the smallest scale you are going to resolve in this experiment is of the size of this entry of this Pitot tube, which is of the order 2, 3, 4 millimeters. So you do not have any information beyond that. In the turbulence of this kind, you expect that the Kolmogorov length scale will be much, much smaller. So you do not probe any scales which are close to intervortex spacing or which are close to 1 over D. This is just the beginning of the inertial range and nothing else.
I might add, they have to use this Pitot tube trick because the thing we used all over in the viscous regime to measure the velocity, velocity measurements, is a hot wire type of instrument which is not it's a semiconducting device, doesn't work when you cross the lambda line because the heat conductivity is so high. So they have no signal from this probe,
exactly.
And they have to develop this new type of probe.
You can't use anemometer in helium 2 by definition because the heat conductivity is a billion times higher than in helium 1. So any delta T is constant immediately, you can't use it. That's a useless technique in helium 2.
And another point they emphasize here, I think for crystals, the kind of question you asked. So the upper curve is for helium 1, which is just a regular classical fluid, so it would be velocity fluctuation in any Navier Stokes fluid.
Right.
So the intermediate curve is just below the lambda point, where you have a small amount of superfluid, but mostly it's normal fluid. They are still measuring the same quantity in that fluid. But the one in the bottom is the case where it's almost all superfluid. There's hardly any normal fluid in there, there's some amount of it. But yet, the point is that the spectral shapes are identical to. That's the main point. And that is the thing that is to be understood. Now, what does it mean? And that's what he will say. You have to look at the
Thank you.
No, I'm
think actually.
No, it's half done. Half done, I know. Only half done.
All right. So what we do in the experiment, I can briefly describe what we are doing. So this is a nuclear pore membrane here. So it's a membrane which has a very small pores in it. It is gold plated from one side, and you have another metal piece from the other side attached to it. If you apply AC voltage, you oscillate this as a capacitor. As you oscillate this membrane, the superfluid flow, because it doesn't have any viscosity, goes freely through. The normal fluid is locked in these pores and goes with the membrane. That way, you excite second sound. That second sound travels across the channel where there is identical thing sitting from the opposite side, which serves as a detector. And what you do is you set the resonance, because in the channel you will have a resonance curve which is roughly of the Lorentzian shape, and you can measure the half width of that resonance and the amplitude of that resonance of the second sound. Then you tow the grid through the channel and you create a tangle of quantized vortices. These quantized vortices attenuate the second sound in the similar fashion as if you propagate a sound through this room and you have ropes hanging here from the ceiling, they will attenuate the first sound too. There are subtle differences. For example, the second sound is attenuated mostly by the thermal conduction rather than by viscosity. But you may think about it as a full analogy. So if there is a turbulence present inside this experimental volume, the amplitude goes down, and we can measure this amplitude as it decays, as it recovers, as the turbulence decays here. Then it is possible to convert this measurement into vorticity, believing the definition of vorticity from a rotating bucket, that the vorticity is exactly equal quantum times vortex line density. If you do that, then you can get the experimental data on decaying vorticity in a finite channel. You can do that using this formula here. If you adapt the formula from rotating channel, it's slightly different because there all vortices are parallel and they all attenuate the second sound. Here the tangle is random, so you have to average out because only those vortices which are perpendicular to the second sound attenuate. So you only measure the fraction of it, but you can work it out mathematically rather easily. So there is a formula which you can use to convert your experimental data into decaying vorticity. The experiment...
I mean superfluid
vorticity.
Yeah.
And actually, it's good to keep in mind that what we actually measure is the vortex line density. It's not the vorticity. But believing the full analogy between the normal eddies and superfluid eddies, you may think, if there is a full matching, that you are measuring the RMS vorticity of the entire fluid. It is very vague, and I will go in the end of this to that and say about limitations of this approach. But in order to discuss our results, I need to believe now, at least for a while, that I'm measuring the vorticity, all right?
But what is the, you know, the quantity that you actually measure in a sense of this amplitude of second sound? So what do you measure? You measure temperature or...?
No, I measure the amplitude of the voltage which I take from here, because this will be oscillating here, and there is a bias voltage there. So as it oscillates, it will induce a voltage on this capacitor plate. That capacitor plate from the receiver goes to the locking amplifier, which is biased by exactly the frequency to which we just do this. So that way, I know how the amplitude changes due to attenuation, due to second sound attenuation, due to presence of the quantized vortices.
Is using this type of sensor much better than using ordinary volumetric just because I asked you this question because I know that Tapping and Nova have terrible problems trying to measure second sun attenuation using simple bolometers.
Yes, it is very difficult. And that's also because this is nice and flat. And you can mount these sensors flat with the wall. Mm-hmm. And that it is much more favorable conditions for setting the second sound resonance standing wave. If you have just the point-like sensor, it will irradiate the second sound in all the angles, right? And the simple picture that I drawn here will be not valid. That's one question. The other question is about the sensitivity of these bolometers and sensitivity and efficiency of creating the second sound signal with these. These are very efficient indeed. Yes, because the second sound is longitudinal wave, so it goes this way, right? So if you have a row which goes... Yeah, you just decompose into one component and the other and just... So it looks in reality like this.
It's a plausible thing what you said. I don't know if there are detailed calculations to show that what you said is correct. I mean, I don't know. Let's make the thing that this is a final word. I'm not sure.
What happens in 2D? Is there any calculation for 2D super fluid and a second sound? In that case, everything is in play.
My point is that in 2D there is actually a very complicated situation as the sounds. There is something which is called second sound propagating there, but it's affected by something which is called third sound. And you have also fourth sound there. There are four different types of sound in the superfluid. The third sound is on the film that involves the surface variation on the film. And the fourth sound is if you have a very confined space, the normal component is partially blocked by this small size effect because of finite viscosity. You have almost only the superfluid moving, right? So it is not obvious to me how to perform these experiments in 2D and whether you can do it in principle.
Although in some sense, the question is answered by the rotating case because all the vortices are aligned there. So
Yes. That's what it has done, and that's what the calibration comes from. The original experiment.
I'm saying if you are in 2D and if I draw one of the vortices, can I stop the second sound?
No. Now I understand. I understand. It is quite resolved because in the rotating case, right, if you send a second sound wave across the cylinder, which rotates this way, the second sound is being attenuated. If you send the second sound signal vertically, it doesn't attenuate with rotation. There are experiments like that. So this is the experimental setup. This is a channel here, which is about 50 centimeters long, 1 centimeter squared in cross-section. These are these transducers here. They are about centimeter in diameter also. So what actually we have, we are sampling in a volume which is roughly a centimeter cubed. And that's the beauty about that. Because in normal turbulence, what you do, you measure the velocity fluctuations in a point. And you must do that 10 million times to calculate the turbulent quantities. Of course, you are paying a price for that, because doing that, you also know fluctuations. Measuring here, I don't know about fluctuations. But the nature does the averaging for me already in quite nice and efficient way. Because I get the information at the same time from all this volume, averaged from these vortices. And that's why we have enormous sensitivity and dynamic range. Before I just try to disentangle this data, I would like to point out that this stretches across almost 6 orders of magnitude. All right? And this is decaying vorticity. And it goes like T^-3/2, roughly. If you translate that into the language of the decaying energy, this would be -2. So instead of 6 orders of magnitudes, that would be roughly 8 or even more. So there is no analog in classical turbulence that you can go even close to this dynamic regime which we have here. And also, we can tow the grid through this channel with different velocities, starting from like centimeters per second up to several meters per second, changing the mesh Reynolds number from like 10^3 up to 1,000,000. And still, the decay is universal in some parts, so these are different Nash Reynolds numbers, and I will go now and explain the details. But to do so, I need to show you at least a cartoon how we feel the ordinary classical turbulent decays. So the simplest possible explanation for decaying turbulence is the following. You have the low temperature part of the three-dimensional spectrum, which is like AK to the M. And if you believe in the Safman invariant, M is equal to 2. If you believe in Loitsansky invariant, it should be 4. There are some possible other scenarios which we discussed with Greg Eink in depth. But let me stop here. At least from classical turbulence results, I don't know about any other decaying turbulence results that would strongly contradict Safman invariant with M is equal to 2. And then, I mean, in this talk I neglect intermittency completely. I have K41 scaling there. So the turbulence as it decays, you have a spectrum which looks like that. Of course, energy-containing length scale grows. But this is only true for infinite turbulence box. And this is the original comptable coursing calculation out of 66 and Safman redundant calculation in 71, which tells you the decay should go like the exponent minus 1.2. But if you take into account the finite size of the channel, it is clear that physically significant vortices can't be any bigger than the size of the channel. So you are limited here by 2 pi over d, where d is the characteristic size of your channel. So as the turbulence decays, right, energy-containing length scale starts to reach the size of the channel and then will be saturated by this size of the channel, and the decay must change character. It is more complicated than that, because this was a rough approximation in which we just approximated this energy-containing eddy peak by sharp kink. It is rounded, actually. And you may see that as you approach the 2 pi over d, the size of the channel, the effective m, if you want to characterize here by some effective m, goes down. So the decay of the turbulence slows down. And eventually, if you are very close, you may say this m is effectively zero. So you have completely different power law. And this is not the end of the story, because of course we are dealing with the viscous fluids. So you have to take into account the Kolmogorov cutoff. And the Kolmogorov length scale, as the turbulence decays, also grows. And you may show that it grows faster than the energy-containing length scale grows. So the distance between them goes down as the turbulence decays. So in the finite channel that you have, actually, eventually it looks only like that. You don't have any inertial range there left. So this is the decay model which we have been working on quite intensely for some time. And there is a long paper which we published and has been accepted now to physics of fluids, rather boring one and a long one. But we predict, according to this scenario which I showed you, 4 different regimes of the decay. The first one is the same as in ordinary wind tunnel. Ordinary wind tunnel predicts that the energy should decay as T to minus 1.2. But using the relationship between epsilon and omega, epsilon equals nu omega squared, you figure out that the energy decay, epsilon goes like minus 2.2, and that's omega squared. So the omega should go like minus 1.1, minus 1110. And we see that here in this experiment. Although this experiment is not very well suited to investigate this part of the decay. If you wanted to compare the normal classical wind tunnel, say that of Comte-Belot and Corsin, with other things, so the saturation, which I have been talking about, and I will talk later, to see that in ordinary wind tunnel, that wind tunnel should have been a kilometer long. And if you want to see the dynamic diapason, which we have seen here, it must have been 1,000 miles long. So it's no way near you can do these experiments in classical turbulence, although if you do Todgate experiments in classical turbulence, you can increase the dynamic range up to, say, 3 or 4 orders of magnitude. And Cerini, actually, and his students, they did these experiments with towing the grid. And Da Silva and Fernando also did. But still, it's nowhere near to these data. And what is the beauty is that it doesn't matter at which temperature between 1 and 2K, where the normal to superfluid density ratio changes by more than order of magnitude, you perform the experiments. The decay is qualitatively always the same. It shows all these features. In the beginning here, this is normalized by 1110, so you see a plateau here. Then later on, as you approach saturation, you see a plateau with omega going as minus 5.6, which you get from the decay formula if you put there m is equal to 0, effectively. And then you get minus 3/2. So, 5.6 comes from this formula here, which is normal Safran calculation. If you put that effective m due to this broadening of this peak, which is roughly 0. And we see that minus 5.6 quite clearly. And I would like to note that you can do this prediction only for vorticity, not for decaying energy, for technical reasons. That's because all this approach is based on calculating the superfluid the turbulent energy by taking the spectrum and integrating it from 0 up to infinity. And because the spectrum depends on epsilon, performing the integral, you get a differential equation which contains E and epsilon. Unfortunately, that's non-linear differential equation. But in some cases, you can solve this differential equation and you can come to this power loss I have shown you. But this is only a flavor of what has been done. Sorry? Yeah. So, yes, we do see these four regimes, and in particular, I would like to point out to this third regime, which is the universal decay. This is after the energy-containing length scale was saturated by the size of the channel. Then the regime is universal. It doesn't depend on this low-temperature part of the spectrum. It only depends on the Kolmogorov constant and the viscosity and the size of the channel. And as you can see, it's indeed a case. No matter from which Reynolds number we start, we always come to this universal decay. And because that formula contains kinematic viscosity, the value at any point here tells me what is the kinematic viscosity of the superfluid. And we can measure this kinematic viscosity as a function of temperature, which was done by Steve Stalp. There are these blue curves here, and by us with Jody Miller recently. We got roughly a very good experimental agreement. And the interesting point is that you can't describe this effective kinematic viscosity neither by mu upon total density nor by mu upon normal density. So that's some kind of a feature which is totally new. And in the remaining of my talk, if you allow me, I can explain how I understand, or how we understand, this enhancement of the kinematic viscosity and its temperature dependence.
Lambda point
is here. So in normal helium 1 above here, there is no questions. It is simply mu over rho and that's it. It should go like that. But then you have two choices. You can put mu over rho total or mu over rho n, and this is the experimental data. Neither. I must say that the experiment really measures the combination of the Kolmogorov constant upon kinematic viscosity. And this data here have been calculated taking the Kolmogorov constant value being 1.62. You can take any value for that because it's not very precisely known, as Cyril pointed out. But the shape would be the same. Sorry?
And it might be temperature dependent.
It might be temperature dependent, but...
It destroys the speech completely.
It might be, yes. Yes, you are right. But if you believe that there is some universality of the Kolmogorov constant, after all, Kolmogorov starts to talk about fluids which is highly turbulent and where viscosity doesn't play any role, so you would expect that for inviscid fluid, so to speak, there is no point why to change this concept. But you are right. In principle, yes, there might be many reasons for that. Okay.
Question about the experimental setup. So you have, well, not setup, but about what you're measuring. So you have the standing wave.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you're exploiting different variants of standing waves. So you may have different lines, right? You might connect different standing waves and measure.
We set the resonance frequency. We know what is the propagating velocity. Yes, we go, usually we use something like 40s component. We exactly know, you can see every single of them. If you sweep the frequency, you see all these resonance curves.
I'm wondering, I'm just any information from switching from one resonance to other and comparing data. You can
do the calculation for without taking into account the standing wave resonance, simply by taking into account that as the second sound propagates, it decays exponentially. Then it reflects and goes back and decays exponentially, and so on. You do the proper calculation, which involves not just simply second sound standing wave calculation, but then you have to calculate everything. Well, we can talk later. I have done the calculation, and Steve Staub has done the calculation, and that formula which I showed is actually the approximation of this general calculation, which is based on the expansion of the hyperbolic cosine being 1 plus x squared. Okay, now about this. There is this paradox about temperature dependence of effective kinematic viscosity. We have been talking already about these new length scales which are set in superfluid. So we don't know exactly how the scaling, how the energy spectrum would look like. Let me assume, and I emphasize, let me assume it's Kolmogorov. And let me assume that there is some characteristic dissipation length in superfluid which I can then express using the usual Kolmogorov-like scaling, and I prescribe to the pure superfluid some effective viscosity, US. That would be at absolute zero temperature, right? I know that there is this mutual friction mechanism that puts these two fluids together, at least somehow, maybe totally, but somehow. But now, for a while, let's think that there are completely independent velocity fields. So what I have is a pure normal fluid and pure superfluid with Kolmogorov-like scaling with some effective cutoff, un, and pure superfluid with some effective scaling given by that. And now, I assume that I'm pumping the energy, that this is statistical equilibrium, turbulent state. So all the energy which I'm putting here, epsilon, passes through this and gets dissipated on this end. Fine. Usually in turbulence, we talk about energy in terms of velocity variance. Here we deal with a fluid which has different density. So it's much more useful to speak about turbulent energy per unit mass than per unit volume. To calculate that, you have to multiply by rho n and rho s. So this expression here, in this approximation, gives you the amount of the turbulent energy in the flow, supposing that I am pumping here with the rate epsilon. Now, let me think that I switch on this mutual friction mechanism And that mixes everything up in such a way that I have one fluid. If I have one fluid, I have one energy spectrum, which would be characterized by some effective kinematic viscosity here. I am still pumping the same energy through here, and it comes out from here. And this energy is here. If I compare these two formulas, I can get the formula for effective kinematic viscosity, which is like this. Unfortunately, if you do that, you get this line here, which doesn't give you this enhancement. How to understand that? And it turns out that qualitatively at least, but quantitatively I can't do it, qualitatively up to the degree that you can describe the quantum mechanics using classical kind of approximation, which is very rough, but gives you at least a flavor of what might be going on, is the following. It's known that Allen Wynen found it a long time ago, that in the rotating bucket you have a mutual friction force. And experimentally has been found, it depends on two constants, which are called mutual friction coefficients. And it's also known that this one is much bigger than this one, so for this rough calculation I can forget about this. And now...
Do you remember the balance for B and D prime?
B is roughly 1, and B prime in the temperature range between 1.1 up to 1.9 is about 0. It's 3 orders of magnitude less. B prime is small. Now, let's think about turbulence as a superposition of eddies, right? So I can view the large eddy being mimicked by the turbulence motion, and that will be very close, like in rotating bucket. But as I go down to smaller and smaller eddies, this matching can't be complete. And there must be some lag. And this mutual friction is a dissipative mechanism. So what it means is that as I go to smaller and smaller eddies, there will be some energy going out from the turbulent flow due to this mutual friction. So this energy spectrum will be somehow modified. And it will be modified roughly in a way which I try to draw here. Now I say, I can leave the K41 scaling there and assume that I can describe this process by some effective kinematic viscosity, which will be shifted to the left then, in such a way that this energy here will be the same as this energy here. It's a rough model. If I do that, I can get a formula here, which looks like this, rather complicated, but nevertheless, there is one free parameter, A. Because if I calculate this energy due to mutual friction, I don't know how to do it. I can only do dimensional analysis. I know that what I calculate is an energy. It must be proportional to the mutual friction force. To get the energy, I must multiply by some unknown quantity, which will be the dimension of length. Now, in this mutual friction force, I have another unknown quantity, Q, which is the mutual friction velocity. I now make a trick. Take one unknown quantity and the other one, multiply them by each other, and call them other unknown quantity, which is of dimension centimeter squared per second. Nobody prevents me to put their circulation quantum instead, and some arbitrary constant. If I did that, I got this formula here. And with A is equal to 1, you get the figure, which I show here, the green line here. So there is disagreement at above roughly 1.5 K, and you can understand that. That's qualitatively because as you move down, the Kolmogorov eddies in normal fluid grow, because you see that normal fluid kinematic viscosity goes up very, very steeply. So the normal fluid eddies are bigger and bigger and bigger. So below 1.5, for the superfluid with quantized motion, it is possible to match them rather accurately and nicely. That's why you have agreement. And above, you have disagreement. So let me quickly conclude. If I can find it. Well, anyway, I can say in words that we have used helium-2 to study the superfluid turbulence. I hope I convinced you that helium-2 is a useful fluid to study, which deserves the attention of the turbulence community. It exhibits, as far as the decay, classical decay, so we can describe it, at least effectively, in a whole temperature region between 1 up to 2K, classically. And it already helped in understanding of the turbulent decay. Just remember these enormous sensitivities and dynamic ranges and so on. There are many buts. You have followed the talk, and there are gaps there. There are some assumptions which should be put right and straight, and I hope that these two talks in the afternoon, they will give you more flavor. What is the real connection between classical and superfluid turbulence? And if I convinced you that this is reasonable and useful thing to study superfluid turbulence, I would be happy with this talk. Thank you very much for your attention.